Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And it has been ages since I've done one of these cold opens for the podcast. In fact, it's been a long time since I've done an original episode. And for that, I'm sorry that I haven't been able to put one out in a while. Variety of circumstances, family, work, but the same excuses we all give when we're super busy. Sometimes life happens. And also, by the way, I think I should apologize for apologizing because there's a certain level of arrogance I feel to say, oh, I'm sorry I haven't blessed you with new content. Like, you're all sitting there hitting refresh on your podcast apps, just waiting for, oh, when's Matt going to put out another episode? I can't leave the home and until I hear another Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People. Anyway, so what you're going to hear in this one is a live interview. How original is that? And by live, I mean in person, human to human, not Zoom, none of that stuff. And it's a rarer thing during the time of COVID and now the time of Omicron. And speaking of Omicron, I was gone for a while because myself, my girlfriend and her twin sister, we were in South Africa. And we went to South Africa before the variant hit. So that made the second half of the trip a little more interesting. I will say that we were safe the entire time. And it's funny, when we were away, people are like, are you okay? Are you safe? Well, Cape Town and the garden tour and these small little coastal cities or towns and then Stellenbosch, the wine community and that whole wine region, it was all completely safe. And I feel so bad for South Africa because they're about to enter, or they are in their busy season, their tourism season, and so many countries are shutting the door to them. And I'm not going to get into the science of it all. I'm not going to tell you what's the most safe or the least safe or everything in between, but I feel bad because this is a country that's been hit so hard and they need tourism, and it's going to take a big, big hit. So the interview I do, I did two of them while I was there, one with Ken Forrester that you'll hear in a little bit, and this one with Nicholas Bureau of Glenelly Wine Estate. And Glenelly is a very important winery, not just because they make really good Chardonnay and incredible Bordeaux blends and incredible Cabernet Sauvignon, but they're an important one because they sort of helped raise the status of South African wine. And the reason is the person who purchased this property is May Elaine de Lonkasing. And she purchased in 2003, the first vintage in 2008. So who is May Elaine, you asked? Glad you asked. Well, Nicholas Bureau is the grandson, and she is still alive. She's won every award possible in the world of wine, lifetime achievements. She is a rock star. She also happens to be the owner, or was the owner and managing director of Chateau Pichon Ronville, Comtesse de Lalande, if you want to do the whole name. And she was doing that job for over 30 years, oversaw the incredible 1982 vintage. For people who don't know, this is one of the great Bordeaux's in Bordeaux. Now I feel like I was doing Austin Powers there when it's like, allow myself to introduce myself. It is one of the biggest houses. It is a second growth. It is an incredible winery. I've been blessed to be able to try their wines a couple times. They're incredible. So for her to go from that world and explore Stellenbosch and decide that this climate, this microclimate, this soil, this is perfect. This is a perfect new adventure. This is a perfect place to make wine. And not just wine, let's make Cabernet, which of course is, between Cabernet and Merlot. I mean, these are the big grapes of Bordeaux. We talked to a lot of winemakers, and they told us about this, the importance, what this meant for the South African wine scene to have May Elaine come there and to have her wines do really well and get crazy scores. Because it's sort of, it's going to be hyperbolic to say she blessed the region. No, that would be an insult to all the hardworking winemakers and wineries that have been doing it for years and years and years and decades and decades. But really what it is, it's an acknowledgement that, yes, this little piece of the wine world makes great wine and that it is capable of making high-end boutique style wines made for aging, high end. This is your anniversary, Saturday night, New Year's Eve wine, that they can do it. This winery had a big, and still does, a big impact, on the entire region. And what amazed me about these wines, and not just here, but at so many of the wineries that we visited, was the quality of the Chenin Blanc or the Cab or the Chardonnay, the quality at the $15 to, say, $25 range. Like, think about your Cabernet Sauvignon. You know, a lot of it, we get it from California. And the problem is, for $15 to $20, $25, it's going to be hard to find one that really feels like it is embracing the varietal typicity of Cabernet, what you want. You know, red fruit, dark fruit, plum, cassis, whatever, tobacco. We know all the terms. Because the reason is, in California, as you know, the price for real estate, for equipment, taxes, labor, it's expensive. Do you know how hard it is to find a $20 Napa Cab that really hits the spot? We tried tons for, like, you know, their entry level Cabernet, which is for Glenallie, called Glass Collection. It's like $15, and more than enough complexity and black fruit and spice. Their Chardonnay, their stainless steel Chardonnay, had more body than I expected for under $20. And then you go up to their 2015 Estate Reserve, and then their big powerhouse wine that would be about $55, the Lady May. And these were 2015 vintages. I appreciated that they sort of, you know, they released these wines a little bit later. These wines, just the depth, the complexity, they all, not all, but most of the wines I tried, they overshot. You're drinking value. You know, you think you're drinking 28 when you're drinking 17, that kind of thing. And what I loved about this trip was it certainly opened my eyes to the wines of South Africa. It is a bit of a blind spot for me. I find it hard to keep up with every region. I think it's impossible. I mean, hell, just try to keep up with Italy on its own and you could spend 6 months and you still won't get it all. So, and I think we all have this. We all have regions and countries we don't know as well. You know, I mean, I'm big and heavy on Ontario and Germany and New Zealand and Spain, and, you know, recently more Spain. So that means other countries, they're not going to get the time. Remember, there's only 24 hours in a day. You're not going to get into everything. So what I loved about this was, A, the region. I cannot stress this enough. When it is safe to travel and feasible and you're not stuck trying to find a way home, by the way, shout out to Lufthansa and Frankfurt. That was the only way we were able to get home from Cape Town to Toronto, was stopping off there after the Americans shut down the border. I'm not going to get into politics or anything. But travel to Stellenbosch. It is gorgeous. I've been to New Zealand and Spain and Italy and France. And I've been blessed and lucky enough to go to these wonderful, gorgeous regions. And I will put Stellenbosch up with any of them. In fact, some of them are far more dramatic. And the wine tourism there is so great. And what makes it great is that almost every vineyard, you're going to get this stunning view and you're going to get mountains and opulence and giant tasting rooms, but none of them are like crazy packed and incredibly professional staff. What I love is you're going to get this contrast. You're going to get beautiful, gorgeous, opulent, but yet when you meet everyone, it's going to feel down to earth and nothing's that expensive. And it's not like Burgundy where it's impossible to find them, or other places where you got to spend a ton just to get a taste in. You got to make a reservation a week in advance. No. It is very simple and easy, and you're going to feel spoiled, and it's not that expensive. My point here is go. The chance you can do this. And I just love, though, that I was able to expand my own palate about what Cabernet is in South Africa, because honestly, I didn't really know. I didn't know a lot about it. I knew I drank more of their Syrahs and their Chenin Blancs. Didn't really drink a lot of their Chardonnays. I had the odd Bordeaux blend here or there, but really not a ton. So I love that I was able to sort of expand my palate and just learn more what these wines are about. And I didn't really understand that South Africa, the tip of the spear for them, their number one, their calling card is Cabernet Sauvignon. Didn't know that. And now it'll certainly change my buying habits, my spending habits. When it comes to buying wine, I'm certainly going to start adding more South African Cabernet into my fridge, cellar, whatever. I don't have my own cellar. My stepdad does. I just take part of it. It just sounds fancy to say my cellar. Oh, it'd be good to have a cellar. I'm in a condo. Don't think you could do a cellar in a condo. I feel I'd be breaking some of the rules here. Man, there are a lot of rules. Anyway, getting off topic. So the first winery that we're going to try is, again, it's called Glenallie Wine Estate, and it is the chief executive, Nicolas Bureau, again, the grandson of May Elaine de Longcasing. We'll see how I did on her name. Two little quick points. One, my tasting notes on this one are absolute trash. I do better with Ken Forrester the next day, my other interview. And I think I was still just a little bit rattled because we hadn't figured out how we were going to get home. Again, our flight from Cape Town to Newark to Toronto, that one was gone. So I apologize. And I hope I don't... I was listening back and I feel like I'm short-selling these wines, but it just... what a great range. And I've always said, if your entry, there's almost nothing more impressive than when you make an entry, your entry level wine has depth. And it is both just drinkable, but also, you know, it can make you think. And these wines did that. So I apologize, to Nicholas if it seemed like I was shortchanging it, because these were in great wines. And then I loved how some of them were from 2015. And the Lady May, if you can get it, it's going to be $55-$60. But this, for an almost 100% Cabernet with that depth, that powerhouse, you know, just that dark cherry, the plum, the spice, the cassis, it's all there. And it's still, at $60 is not cheap, you know, it's not cheap by any stretch, but usually for a wine like this with that grape, you're probably hitting early triple digits. So a hell of a value. The other thing is, and this was my fault, I should have done the interview in a different room because it's going to sound echoey. It's not the best. It's not going to be the best sound quality. I'm going to say that right off the top. But we only had a certain amount of time with Nicholas. I didn't want to take up too much of his time. I always feel guilty taking up too much of anyone's time because to me, time is the single most valuable commodity on planet Earth beyond real estate, especially if you can get a detached home in any major city. You're doing well. You know, I should have said, can we go to a different room? Like, no, we'll do it here. And if I all sound distracted or if you hear a little clicking noise, I kept trying to plug in my computer. And you know when your cord is near the end of its life and you're plugging it in, but it's not charging. And then I'm looking down at the battery symbol and it's like at 68%. And then you look again, and it's at 54. And you're like, wait a minute, 5 minutes has passed. Have you already gone down like 9%? So I had a lot going on. And I'm not using this as an excuse, just sort of explain that the technical quality probably should have been a little bit better. Thankfully though, Nicholas is great and has got some great stories, and you'll hear more about his grandmother. You'll hear more about the wines of Stellenbosch, what makes this region so good, why they decided to come here, and just the nature of their wines and just the wines of South Africa in general. I think it's a good sort of dipping your toe into this incredible, this beautiful, this nice, this warm, this welcoming region that I, again, cannot recommend high enough. Also, a shout out to the wines of South Africa. I got in touch with them before my trip, and a couple days later, Laurel contacted me back, and she set up this beautiful two-day itinerary, and I want to give a shout-out to her and the wines of South Africa, because they set it all up. Again, it was eye-opening. It was educational. It was fun. We met so many great people, and I learned a ton, and my journey is nowhere near done. Because of this trip, I'm going to do more exploring of the different varietals, the different winemakers, and by the way, yes, there is good Pinotage. There is actually good Pinotage. I'd never had a good Pinotage in my life from one that I purchased here in Canada. And I tried plenty of good stuff over there. It is actually true. So that was nice as well. All right, that is enough rambling by me. Without further ado, here is from the chief executive of Glenelie Wine Estate in Stellenbosch. It is Nicholas Bureau.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. And of course, why do one back in Ontario when you can be in South Africa where we are completely locked down? But whatever, that's a subject for another day. I'm with Nicholas Bureau at this gorgeous site in Stellenbosch, South Africa, at Glenelie. Nicholas, thank you so much for being part of the podcast.
Thanks, Matt, for coming to visit us. And great to have you.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I was wondering first if you could just start with what your title is, your role here when it comes to making the wines.
So I've got this pompous title of CEO of the company. But as I was saying, I'm a bit more of a coordinator between the great people who work here for us. I came to South Africa 2 years ago to basically step in as my grandmother, who's still with us and still very busy. Unfortunately, hasn't been able to travel to South Africa for the past 2 years now. So I'm here in Stellenbosch and running the business.
Let's talk a little bit about your grandmother, because Glenelie, the story of Glenelie kind of starts with her, doesn't it?
Absolutely. So my grandmother is quite a figure in the world of wine. She was born in Bordeaux in 1925 in a family of property chateau owners, the Miai family. The Miai family initially was a family of wine brokers, and they started in the late 18th century working in the wine trade. And progressively, they started to buy chateaus, and they really culminated in the late 20s when my great-grandfather and his brother were running a number of chateaus, mainly in the left bank of Bordeaux in the Médoc. And among others, there were the likes of Chateau Palma, Chateau Dozac, Chateau Couffrand, Chateau Citran, Chateau Siran, which is still owned by my uncle, and Chateau Pichon-Longueville, Comtesse de la Lande, which my grandmother inherited in the late 70s. And Pichon-la-Lande, as you know, is a second growth of Bordeaux. But in some vintages, the wines that my grandmother made were really on par with the first growth. So thinking of vintages like 82, 89, 95, 96, fantastic wines. I mean, if you're Cabernet lover or Bordeaux Blend lover, these are probably among the best you'll ever try. So this is really the roots of my family. But my grandmother, adventurous as she is, always wanted to make wine outside of France. And she looked at many different countries and several joint ventures. And she thought that South Africa was probably the most exciting place to be in the early 2000s. So she set off to here to the Cape, visited several estates. Most of them were existing estates. Some of them were fairly well-known brands. But when you're my grandmother and you've got this spirit of adventure, you start from scratch a vineyard at the age of 78, which is what she did. So she bought Glenelie here in Stellenbosch. And this was a fruit farm in the early 2000s. And she uprooted all the trees and planted just over 60 hectares of vineyards. So this is when it all started here in 2003. And here we are just over 18 years later with, I think, a very established brand distributed in 20 countries all over the world. So we're getting there.
What's crazy is your grandmother, I mean, she was probably not making wine because she was a teenager, but she went through the Second World War in Bordeaux, and to go from there to now making wines here, just what a crazy adventure that she's been on. I was wondering if you could tell people a little bit about just this area. What makes Stellenbosch such a unique and vital place for making wine?
So just on the Second World War, you're absolutely right. And there's actually a very good book called Wine and War, which I'm sure you can find on Amazon or wherever, which tells the story of the German occupation of France during the Second World War. And the part written about Bordeaux is mainly actually about my grandmother.
Really?
How they hid some Jewish families in the chateau at Palma, and how my grandmother helped the local resistance network, even though she was in her late teens. So there's a very, if you find this book, Wine and War, definitely have a read, because it's a very interesting story. So now back to Stellenbosch. What makes Stellenbosch special? I think, first of all, is the soils. The soils we work on here are some of the oldest viticultural soils in the world. And they predate the likes of the Alps by, I think, 300 million years. So very old soils. Also, what's interesting is that the tip of the continent during the Ice Age wasn't covered in ice. So we haven't had the glaciers moving the topsoils around. And basically, the soils we have here are the soils which are decomposed on themselves. And they've never really really moved. I'm sure you've heard of the Cape Floral Kingdom.
Yeah.
And I think these unique soils also produce these unique flora we have here in the Cape. So that's one thing. The second thing, I think, is the proximity with the ocean. We are about 15 kilometers away from the ocean. and we get that constant breeze, which really, even though we are 33rd degrees south, we are actually in an area where you can make wines with elegance and freshness thanks to that kind of cool wind we get continuously from the ocean. The climate, Mediterranean climate, so similar to the type of climate you find in the south of France or northern Italy, so very good for viticulture. And now more specifically Stellenbosch. Stellenbosch is very well known for its Bordeaux blends, and more specifically Cabernet Sauvignon. And this is also really what attracted my family here, coming from Bordeaux to South Africa. You know, there are other regions which are known for, let's say, Pinot Noir or more Rhone varietals, which probably wouldn't have worked for us, but here Stellenbosch, where Cabernet is king, is really where we had to be. So that's just a few words on Stellenbosch.
So let's start trying some of the wines here, because I'm also here with my girlfriend and her sister, and they're staring at the wines, and you know, you want to have some. So we're going to be trying two Chardonnays. What's the first Chardonnay?
So we have only one white varietal here on the farm, which is Chardonnay, the rest being Bordeaux varietals and Syrah. And we produce the two big styles of Chardonnay, so unoaked Chardonnay and barrel fermented Chardonnay. So the first one is called the Glass Collection Chardonnay, and this is the unoaked Chard, which is obviously just stainless steel, fermented at low temperature. And the idea here is to make a very vibrant, fresh style of Chardonnay, which I like to describe as a really good alternative to Sauvignon Blanc, for instance. And I think a great wine for lunch, or, you know, a light wine. Some vintages were quite low alcohol as well, maybe 12.5 alcohol. Nice crisp acidity, nice citrus notes. And yeah, a good example, I think, of a fresh, clean Chardonnay.
I'm curious, and you're right, yeah, just very fresh, good acid, you know, nice tropical fruit. Like this is, you know, yeah, this is a really well-made unoaked Chardonnay. What I'm curious about is why Chardonnay? We know that Sauvignon Blanc seems to be the number one grape. Chenin Blanc gets a lot of attention here. What was it about Chardonnay that, because again, you're a Bordeaux producer.
Yeah.
You look at Burgundy, you're like, ah, get out of here, Burgundy. Yeah. No one likes you. What was the reason behind doing Chardonnay?
I think it was the, here's too warm to grow Sauvignon Blanc, to make good quality Sauvignon Blanc. Actually, in Stellenbosch, there's not a lot around. You'll find it in a slightly more coastal region of Oregon, Mukabe, or higher up in the mountains. But Sauvignon Blanc really was a no-no. And Chenin, there's a lot around here already. A lot of it is actually old vineyards, old Chenin vineyards. And I think those are the interesting Chenins to work with. And planting young Chenins, I think, would have been out of sync with the rest of the industry. So we thought Chardonnay, why not? As you say, it's not a Bordeaux varietal, but in my family, we've always been super open to other varietals. And my grandmother grew up, not as a young girl, but as a probably teenager in her late teens, tasting wines with her father and uncle. And obviously, she would taste Chardonnay from Burgundy, and she's always loved Chardonnay. So for us, it was a no-brainer. And I think it's also such a nice, versatile grape that we thought we'd have a go at it. And we only have 5 hectares of Chardonnay, and our two Chardonnays have been extremely popular, and we don't really have enough of it for the market. So that's the reason behind it. Really.
Yeah. It's an interesting point, just about, again, geographically where you are here, not the right climate for Sauvignon. And then tell me a little bit about the oak version. What's the treatment?
The other Chardonnay we produce is called the Estate Reserve Chardonnay. And this is a lightly oaked style of Chardonnay. I think we all know that one of the main problem with Chardonnay in the past, or still, has been over-oaking, and people turning away from Chardonnay because they didn't like that really rich, buttery aromas coming from the oak mainly. So here we try to be very careful with yoking, and this is why we use large 500-liter oak barrels. And we only use between, let's say, 15 and 20% new oak.
Okay. Yeah.
The rest being second and third fills. And this creates a wine which I think the fruit is still the main act, and the oak is more of the support act. So you'll probably feel on the nose the oak is relatively present, and this is because this is a 2020 vintage. So it's still quite young, but this is a wine, because it's got this beautiful acidity, it will age really, really well. And, you know, recently I opened a bottle of 2010, so just nearly 12-year-old bottle of Chardonnay, and it was amazingly fresh. And yeah, so if you have cellars and if you have time, these are wines that you should really try and age.
So let's, before we move on... to the reds, and yeah, you're right. There's nothing overly oaky, overly buttery, overly anything.
I think it's definitely a fresh style. You know, the finish has got this beautiful acidity again, which makes you want to have another glass. You know, it's not a heavy style of Chardonnay with residual sugar,
yeah,
which you can sometimes find in the New World. I think this is really not what we're trying to achieve.
And one of the keys is when you can have fresh and oak Chardonnay, because
yeah,
usually that's the enemy of an oak Chardonnay, is it lacks, you know, it's going to lack that level of freshness.
Exactly.
So I'm curious, Nicholas, about you. When did you get into wine?
So I was probably born in the wine.
Yes, you were.
Because I think the first place I went to when I was born... in July 79, the next month in August, I was in Pauillac, where my grandmother, my mother was there just to rest after I was born. So my first few weeks were in Pauillac, in the middle of the vineyard. I grew up in Paris most of my years, and in the UK. And I joined really the wine industry by starting to work for a wine merchant in the UK, in London.
Which one? It was it?
It's called Jerry Bones.
Okay. Yeah.
Still, they both are retail and wholesale. And this is where I learned about all the different wines from the world, because in France, as you know, you don't really have access to them, or they're very difficult to find. So this region is really for me to learn about wines from you know, the rest of the world. And then I joined the Champagne House, still in London, and I worked for them for a few years. I really loved that as well. And then just over 10 years ago, I joined my grandmother to work for Canelli, and I started to run the exports and really start the distribution globally. And 2 years ago, I moved here in Stellenbosch, that's how it all happened.
Nice. Was there, and some people have a specific example, others don't. Was there a bottle? Was there a moment where you tried it? Where you're just like, oh my God, what? I mean, you would have been surrounded by it your entire life. So obviously you might have a different experience, but
yeah.
I was wondering if there was that aha, eureka moment.
It's very, you know, I've been very, very privileged to taste mainly Bordeaux, actually, since I was quite young, from very good chateaus and very good vintages. But probably one of my most amazing bottle I've had the chance to taste was a 1959 Pichon, which is obviously a great vintage, probably not the best, but interestingly, it was the last vintage that my great-grandfather produced on the estate. And this was coming up out of an Imperial, so obviously the big bottle meant that the wine had aged extremely well. And I just thought that wine was really amazing. And so this was probably, let's say, 15 years ago. So the wine was at least 60, 70 years old, and it still had that beautiful freshness and vibrancy to it, which, it's definitely something I remember.
Yeah, that is cool.
Yeah.
It's just that sort of that sense of history, you know,
yeah,
just that moment. I can pause if we want to try the, do we want to try the reds?
Yeah, definitely try the reds.
Perfect. And we're back. We're now going to be trying the reds. What's the first red that we're going to be trying?
Okay, so We had the Chardonnays before, but now we are moving to the reds, which is really the main, the bulk of our production. We make single varietals, we make blends, and Cabernet is really the dominant varietal here on the farm. So the first wine we'll try now is the Glass Collection Cabernet Sauvignon, which is a straight Cabernet from our Glass Collection range, which is our single varietal range, which comes in with a screw cap. And this is really, the idea is to make a good example of the varietal expressing our terroir and expressing the vintage. We really like vintage variation, and you know, it's something we really look for year after year. So straight cab, very little oak on this wine. This will go in barrels for about 12 months, hardly any new oak. And I think you will pick up the one of the big characteristics of Stellenbosch cab is that kind of herbal herbal qualities. Herbal being not meaning green, because we obviously avoid greenness in our wines, but at the same time we avoid overripeness. We really do not like jamminess, overripe notes. So we try and pick as soon as we have phenolic ripeness, so pips and skins, and then we try and preserve that freshness and the fruit. And I think this is what we have here with the cab.
You do. It's actually, this is lovely, and I don't even know what the price is, but I imagine this is good value.
I think this in Canada retails around just under $20, I think.
That's a great price.
Yeah.
You know what? If I was good at for the francophiles out there, this tastes like a well made cru bourgeois, not bourgeois,
bourgeois.
Man, thank you. Like that, yeah, like just. Yeah, the fruit is just in step with the alcohol. Like everything is exactly where it has to be. You know, the red fruit, the dark fruit, it's all just playing around together in the nose and the palate. This is a really good one.
Thanks. And you're saying, I'm sure this is the Francophiles will like this. And this is, you know, what we're trying to do here. We're not trying to make French wine here in Stellenbosch.
No.
But we're trying to make wines which have a good balance, and that means is that balance between the fruit, the alcohol, the acidity, because ultimately, you know, we have this kind of old world philosophy is that wine should be enjoyed with food, and for the pairing to work, you need that balance in the wine. A wine which is like overly ripe or kind of a bit jammy, some people will probably enjoy them on their own, but if you want to pair them with food, then it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
So our philosophy really is to make wines which are food friendly, and we can make interesting pairings as well.
Was there nervousness in your family when your grandmother decided I want to expand to South Africa? Was there any pushback? Like, because I mean, let's face it, the one thing about Bordeaux, like a lot of parts of France, it's very conservative, very steeped in tradition.
Yeah.
So then the idea of, you know, hey, well, I'm heading to Stellenbosch.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a little bit of that. You have to remember that Bordeaux is a harbor, and unlike, let's say, Burgundy, which is very much kind of the deep countryside. Bordeaux has always been looking towards the other countries and all around the world. And I think the Bordelais are known for their spirit of adventure and for getting out there. So yes, South Africa was a bit of an unknown destination to us. Although my grandmother did take us on a family trip in 1998. She took all 7 of her 10 grandchildren on the trip, which was amazing. And this was our first introduction. But then again, you know, I think we all fell in love with the country, and you know, what's not to fall in love with? It's such a beautiful the landscapes, the people, the food, everything. I think is really amazing. And then I think, you know, that was it. My grandmother made the decision, and here we are. And I think with hindsight, it was quite a good decision. You know?
Absolutely. I just took a bit of a sip of the second wine. Before we continue, a lot of people listen to this podcast. They're from Canada, from Ontario, you know, have access to the LCBO. And these, the Glen Ellie wines, they're available Are some of them available?
So they're available in with the LCBO in Ontario. They're available with the SAQ in Quebec. We also have an importer in Saskatchewan in Manitoba. Mm-hmm. So different wines are available in different provinces. Is that what we call a province?
Yeah.
But really look out for them, and you'll have two or three wines, I think, at the same time in the different provinces. So yeah, they are available.
So what's the Estate Reserve?
So the Estate Reserve is our is a red blend, but interestingly, it's not a straight Bordeaux blend. So why do I say that? Because it's got a bit of Syrah in it. The 2015 has 15% Syrah, and this goes back to the old Bordeaux blends. Back in Bordeaux, right up until even after the Second World War, we used to blend some Syrah into our red Bordeaux varietals. Generally, this was done to kind of beef up the wines, especially in vintages where you had really rainy vintages, low alcohol, little color. You would bring in Syrah either from the Rhone or from the south of France, or even sometimes from North Africa. And interestingly, these wines, which were called Hermitage, so Hermitage, as you know, is in the Rhone. Mm-hmm. So to Hermitage a wine was meant to add some Syrah in it. And those wines which were Hermitage were actually more sought after and more expensive than the wines that hadn't been Hermitage. So this wine, the Glenelg Estate Reserve Red, is just a little nod to this style of wines, Cabernet Syrah blend. The Syrah obviously brings a little bit of that spiciness to the blend, which we find very interesting. And I think it makes for a very versatile wine to pair with very different food, with again that little spicy note, which I think is very interesting. Interestingly, in Bordeaux today, there's still two estates making Cab Syrah blends that I know of. Chateau Palma, they make this, I think it's called the 19th century blend, which is obviously not a Margaux because they can't sell it under the Margaux appellation. And the other one is the one made by La Lagune, Caroline Frey. They also own the Hermitage La Chapelle, so they make a blend of La Lagune and Syrah for the Hermitage. So yeah, which we tasted alongside our Glenelg Estate Reserve Red, and really we think that we're offering amazing value for money compared to these two wines, are super super expensive.
And what's the percentage of this one? I know it changes every year with this 2015. What's
So 35% Cab. So again, this varies quite a lot, but it's always Cabernet based. 30 Merlot, 15 Syrah, 10 Cabernet Franc, and 10 Petit Verd.
Okay. And move on to the final wine.
The final wine is our flagship wine. It's called the Lady May. It's named after my grandmother, May de Longzin. She's called May because her roots are Irish, I mean on her mother's side. This is really our take on a Bordeaux blend here made in Stellenbosch. So this is very much Cabernet Sauvignon dominant, with a little bit of Cabernet Franc, Merlot, and Petit Verdot. So very much a left bank type of blend. If you Matt, look to the right, to your left, unfortunately the listeners cannot see, but we are in front of our dominant slope here at Glenelg, which is an east-facing slope, and this is where we source the grapes for this particular blend, this Lady May blend. East-facing means a slope which has a slightly longer growing season. We get more balance in the grapes, and we obviously retain a bit more acidity because the sun just goes on the other side of the hill in the afternoon, and we don't have that kind of scorching heat that you can get here in the Cape in January and February. So this is a relatively small production. We produce between, let's say, 20 and 30,000 bottles a year, and it's consistently been named one of the best Bordeaux blend or Cabernet blend here in South Africa in recent years. So So this is a 2015, which was a fantastic vintage, and it's our current release. So it's a wine we hold back and we put on the market after a few years.
Yeah, I was going to say, even looking at the other wines, the last one also 2015. So you guys, that's a normal part of your philosophy when it comes to releasing the wines, is you hold on to them a little bit longer than maybe some other places?
Yeah, especially for our estate preserve and the Lady May. Because also the style in which we make these wines means that they're probably not approachable when just bottled. You
know? Right, yeah.
They need a bit like in Bordeaux back in the days. It's probably not so much so now anymore. But back in the days, you know, the Bordeaux wines, you wouldn't touch them for at least 10 years. Nowadays, you know, especially from some producers, it will be immediately approachable and drinking. So when our wines are bottled, they need a little bit of time before they start opening up. And so here we are 7 years after the vintage. We think it's the right time for them to start drinking. And I think the Lady May, for instance, has at least another 15 years ahead of it before it starts peaking, really. Mm-hmm. Probably be a bit more, 15, maybe 20 years. We don't know because our first vintage was 2008, which is still very fresh and drinking beautifully now. So we don't have that track record that you would have if we had started a long time ago.
The earthy notes, the mushroom, you know, a lot of the classic things you're looking for, like that dark plum thing, there's a little bit of red currant coming along, nice tannin on it, but you're right, the end, the freshness, you know, the freshness is there, which again screams to the fact that the grapes are on the east facing slope. If you were describing the wine, what are the other things you would be telling people to look for?
Yeah, I think that as you described, the tannins are super fine.
Yeah.
But they're there. I mean, you can still see that this wine has some time to go.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of future.
Yeah. It's funny because we've put this wine in blind tastings and, you know, sometimes against great Bordeaux. And you'll be surprised that not many people will pick this out as being from Stellenbosch for sure. Some people, you know, will think, oh, this might actually be a Bordeaux, which is not our intention, but I think it's the structure of the wine which probably reminds them of a great Bordeaux. And this was actually in the Master of Wine exam, which takes place in London.
Yeah.
A few years back, and I think it was a 2008 vintage. Uh-huh. 2008 was quite a cool vintage, and this was in a lineup of, I think, six caps from around the world. And I think it was very tricky the examiners to put this in the lineup, because I think hardly any of the MW students who, I think all got great credits, could put this in Stellenbosch.
You failed someone, didn't you?
Yeah.
Your wine failed someone who was going for their master wine.
Yeah, exactly. But I think, you know, again, for the Francophiles out there, if you don't know South African wine so well, I think this is a good, very good introduction to Stellenbosch.
Yeah.
Cabernet or Bordeaux blend.
Well, yeah, it's and you're right. There is certain things there that scream out Bordeaux because of the grapes and obviously your philosophy when it comes to making wine. But when you drink it, you can tell, okay, no. This is, you know, the climate is different. And, you know, these are wonderful examples. Because in the end, you don't, as you kind of mentioned, you're not here to make great Bordeaux. You're here to make great South African wine.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think it's a very exciting time for the South African wine industry, because even though, you know, we go on about how it's 350 years since the first vintage and we can date it very precisely, actually the current wine industry as we know it is only really 25 years old. So actually a lot of the vineyard was replanted in the past, you know, 15 to 20 years old. There's some very exciting young winemakers in South Africa who are not afraid to experiment. They're generally super well traveled, they've done harvests in California, in Bordeaux, and everywhere around the world. And I think, like some journalists say, South Africa is probably the most exciting wine region at the moment. And still, because we're still the underdogs, you can find amazing value for money in this country for the wines. So,
well, that's key also, because, you know, not every night is Chateau Palmer night. Now, if it is, good for you, but for 99.9% of the rest of us, it's about finding high-quality wines that aren't going to break the bank. And yeah, absolutely, these ones would, not that the Lady May would be inexpensive, but the Glass Collector, I would say, would be like a high-end Thursday night wine. What has COVID meant for you guys specifically, and also just for the South African wine industry over the last year and a half? And I bring this up at a time, I was recording this, it's November 30th, where I have no idea how I'm getting back home because of Omicron or whatever the hell they're calling the variant and all the travel restrictions. But what has it meant for you guys?
Well, it's, I think, as you've probably followed, it's been even more challenging being a wine producer in South Africa than anywhere else in the world, because we've had all these liquor bans.
So yeah.
We've had four successive periods of up to nearly 2 months where we actually couldn't sell any wine. The first one, actually, we couldn't even export any wine. So for nearly 2 months, we had no income, no revenues. So that was extremely challenging. But then again, I think South Africans are quite resilient people, and we found ways of, you know, like I think learn new ways of selling our wines. Obviously, we discovered the Zooms. I think 2 years ago, I had never heard of the word Zoom. Now I think I've done many, many hours of tastings over Zoom. And actually, interestingly enough, we've had an extremely good 12-month. I think we found new ways of selling our wines and communicating with our clients, be them either, you know, professional or end consumers. So it's been tough, but I think we made it. You know?
I'm glad to hear that, and I'm hoping for the best for you guys going forward. You know, just from what the last year and a half has been, and also you say you were tired of doing all these Zooms. I'm tired of doing. I've done so many Zoom wine interviews as well from people all over the world. It's so great to be able to do one in person here at this gorgeous estate. I don't know when anyone listening can get to South Africa, but Stellenbosch is gorgeous. I mean, come to Glenelly. Your restaurant is awesome, and it overlooks all these vineyards that you were talking about. It overlooks all of them, so people can see for miles and miles around. It's absolutely gorgeous. And thank you so much for hosting myself, my girlfriend and her sister. And we really appreciate you giving us your time.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. And as you say, you know, hopefully when the travel is a bit easier, that you can all come and visit us and discover how amazing the Western Cape is, and you know, wine tourism and all other things that go around it. So, yes, thank you.
Thank you. Everyone, go check out Glenelly.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.